So we're going to talk about pancreatic cancer now. And, you know, when we set up the agenda here, I was like, well, pancreatic cancer is number two here. Hopefully there's going to be enough to talk about. I wasn't so sure when we started planning here. But as we got into it, it looked more and more interesting. I was mentioning the fact that I was asking ChatGPT what was the most important advance in the past year in various tumors, Eileen, and one of the first answer they gave out was pan-RAS inhibition with daraxonrasib. Maybe I'll call it daraxonrasib. Is there a nickname for it yet?
Daraxonrasib.
Daraxonrasib. All right. Well, I'll do the best I can. Anyhow, Eileen O'Reilly and Philip join us here, and Vic Malhotra from FCS. We're going to talk about pancreatic cancer here today. And before we get into it, and Eileen's, of course, from Memorial Sloan Kettering. Philip is from the Henry Ford Cancer Center, and Vic is in Spring Hill, Florida, as part of the FCS. So, Vic, anything you want to ask the faculty? One thing I'm curious about is these new pan-RAS inhibitors. We're going to talk about that. Just kind of curious, start with you, Philip. Any thoughts about why pancreatic cancer seems to be had so resistant to systemic therapy over the years? And with the new development in terms of RAS inhibition, are we going to see a new era here?
Yes, we will, for sure. Because pancreatic cancer, as you know, most of the people have, or most of the tumors contain the RAS mutation. And RAS mutation is central in the biology of the disease. For a long time, we were not able to target RAS. It's like having a golf ball, and then, you know, they have those grooves that are very superficial. You can't fit something into it. Now the scientists found a way of trying to get something which sticks on the protein and then stops it from working. That RAS protein, the signaling, also is responsible for a number of things that happen within the tumor itself. When you think of the tumor, think of not only cancer cells, but also all the microenvironment, which is really the 90% of what you see on a CAT scan is the microenvironment. And the immune-suppressive microenvironment that you see there is also contributed by the RAS activity. So it's going to be a game-changer, no question. It's going to be a very interesting next 5-10 years in getting things put together.
Eileen, any thoughts? I mean, are we going to get, you know, it's amazing how, you know, you take a look at urothelial bladder cancer. We're going to talk about that later. And it wasn't too long ago, all we had to do was talk about chemotherapy. Now, in an hour, you can't even cover what's been done in the last year with ADCs, IOs, et cetera. Are we going to get into a situation where we're going to be using second and third line therapy in pancreatic cancer that's going to really have an impact?
Yeah, I think the answer is no question to this. And just to echo what Dr. Philip mentioned, it's going to be a fundamental time of change in this disease as we get these drugs integrated into first-line setting and then into every other disease setting. And, you know, if people are healthier for longer, they're going to be eligible for further therapies. And I think one of the questions is, you know, what are we going to do about RAS targeting after resistance develops? What will be the strategies there? And there's a whole kind of wave of approaches in development to address this consideration.
I remember there was an ASCO quite a few years ago where for the first time we saw really incredible data with immunotherapy and melanoma. And you know, the melanoma people were just so, you know, they were literally crying in the audience to see this because they'd seen so many patients suffer for so many years. Finally, there was a ray of hope. I think about the two of you who have treated so many people and also people in the audience with pancreatic cancer, hoping that someday we're going to get to a situation where you can really be able to help people more. Vic, any questions?
Yeah, I think in light of what the new data with the KRAS inhibition will discuss, should we be doing NGS upfront on all patients, even in non-advanced setting? Is there value? Is there, an MSI testing, and how is that impacting you? I know that's very low percentage, but there's reports for the very high responses.
Philip? So in my practice, any time I see a new patient with advanced disease, and I have to say here, any patient with pancreatic cancer, I do the germline testing because of what you will hear probably later by Dr. O'Reilly. 40% of the people who have, or more of the people who have BRCA germline mutation don't have a family history, so you have to do that to pick that up. And we're getting increasing number of other mutations that you can work on. I also send the biopsy specimen for for NGS, which you asked me about. Now, that's a bit of a tricky one because you don't always get an answer, because if someone has done a fine needle aspirate, you won't get enough tissue to have that. So what I do is I also, at the same time, include a liquid biopsy for one of the vendors. And so I have all the information. It's not infrequent that you see something more in the liquid sometimes because of the way the biopsy was done. So the short answer is I do all of the above in a newly diagnosed patient. Now, why should I do it also in someone with locally advanced? Well, we're treating them like metastatic at the end. Why do I do it in someone who has localized disease? Because I think you know that there is a study that's looking, for example, via olaparib as an adjuvant in patients with resected disease. And also, very soon, resected disease will be becoming also a way of being treated, or it would be treated with target therapies, including the KRAS. So for me, I really do that for all the patients, to identify patients who will be down, even if I don't treat them right away with anything targeted, but down the road it will be something which they can benefit from.
Yeah, we're going to do a whole module just on EGFR mutant lung cancer and that whole model of targeted therapy. You know, maybe someday we'll get there with pancreatic cancer. Eileen, have you seen a patient with pancreatic MSI high?
Yeah, it's infrequent, about 1% of individuals with this disease, and some driven by Lynch syndrome, some by somatic mismatch repair deficiency. And to answer Dr. Malhotra's question, we don't routinely prioritize MMRD testing, protein testing for this disease. We use next-generation sequencing and try to extract that information by other methodologies. If we're suspicious about it, then we'll use IHC testing to confirm or need a quick answer, and there's a luxury of additional or sufficient tissue.
Yeah, I mean, the whole issue of MSI high is something we'll get into also later on in terms of colorectal cancer. Do MSI-high pancreatic, the rare cases, do they respond to IOs like other MSI patients?
They do. When the tumor is truly mismatch repair deficient, yes, they respond well, and there are some durable responses, some complete responses, both to single agent, dual immune checkpoint blockade, although maybe not quite as good as other diseases, but definitely they do respond.
All right, Philip, so while we're waiting for these really exciting data to mature, let's talk about where we are right now, particularly in terms of upfront management and management of these patients.
So, thank you. Certainly exciting data, but we also have to remember that we're still using chemotherapy every day, the regular chemotherapy, and in patients who come to us. But also these treatments will apply to patients who have localized disease or locally advanced disease. So continuing our experience with chemotherapy isn't going to stop. We're going to modify that by adding target agents. Certainly, the hope is that we will be replacing them with target therapy, but that will be a while away. How do I choose treatment for patients with the pancreatic cancer at this time, which is the conventional chemotherapy? Performance status and age are obviously very important in this setting. Organ function, liver function in particular, neuropathy. Some of these things I put here may not be exactly why to choose one regimen against the other, but also the dosing, because you have to be very careful about the dosing. Certainly, germline testing, as I mentioned, is important, because if you have someone with BRCA or PALB2 mutation, for example, these patients definitely require a platinum-based treatment, which can range from a FOLFIRINOX, lanreotide, or a platinum treatment like gemcitabine cisplatin. DYPD and UGT1A1, now it's integral into my workup of patients. Every patient who I see, in addition to what I mentioned to you, I also do the DYPD and UGT1A1. And luckily, I get it also from when I send it to liquid biopsy, now I get that result. Genomics, the NGS, whether tissue and or liquid, KRAS we talked about, but there are others that are really very important, and Dr. O'Reilly will expand on that. But also it's very important to talk about clinical trial availability and access nowadays, because patients will be more and more and pressing us even more for clinical trials. So we have to be careful for that, not careful as in whether we agree or not, but how to do it, because finding a clinical trial for a patient is really very can be very lengthy process. And I was giving a talk recently to a advocacy group, and a gentleman also gave a talk on his, they have a platform of trying to find clinical trials for pancreatic cancer patients. I was really pleasantly surprised how simple it is for a patient to do that, because the clinicaltrials.gov is not the most friendliest one at times because of the way it's structured. But also I believe in patient preference and the shared decision with the patient when we choose a regimen, depending on the patient's social status, what they want and what they're trying to do. So these are the two randomized phase 3 trials that established FOLFIRINOX and also gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel as standards of care. And again, these trials were done, one was done predominantly in Europe, the other one was global, and you see the number of patients that went into it. And the primary endpoint was very simple, overall survival. In my opinion, 5 years from now, we're not going to use overall survival primary endpoint because you're going to end up with other active lines of treatment and you're going to be becoming like colorectal cancer or breast cancer where you use progression-free survival. In these trials, you can see that the FOLFIRINOX was superior to gemcitabine and the same for gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. And on the right side of the slide, I tried to run a quick comparison. This is between trial comparison of side effects, and neutropenia was more with FOLFIRINOX, and diarrhea was more with FOLFIRINOX, fatigue was more. These things you know about, and neuropathy for some reason is more with the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. So this is really looking at the original regimens from both. But the reality is that this doesn't apply, maybe, because with both regimens we do some degree of modifications nowadays, and we can discuss that later on. And then the question always was, is the triplet better than a doublet? And it went backwards and forwards, and it's still, to some extent, may be, but this study, which was a large trial over 750 patients, looked into the triplet versus a doublet. Here, the use of nanoliposomal irinotecan, which has a different pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic profile, which might be more to do also with what it can do in the tumor microenvironment I mentioned to you before. This study, a phase 3 trial, which was the Napoli 3, and Dr. O'Reilly was a senior author on it, looked into the NALIRIFOX versus gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, standard dose gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. And I'm comparing the dosing, because this is very important to understand two things. One is the outcomes and the toxicity profile of the trial, but also to give you a feel of what it means to dose reduce in a patient with pancreatic cancer who is 72 years of age and has maybe one or two other comorbidities. Anyway, so the use of IV bolus was not part of NALIRIFOX, and you can see in red, it's not really part of most people who do FOLFIRINOX now. The oxaliplatin dose was lower, so we think, well, is it a lower dose, but did it really compromise the combination? And the irinotecan was also lower. This is nanoliposomal irinotecan, although nowadays we use 150 instead of 118, the straight FOLFIRINOX. So in this trial, you can see that the triplet with NALIRIFOX was superior to the doublet of gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel in both overall survival and also progression-free survival. On the right side of the slide, you see that the differential or the differential benefit went through across most of the subgroupings that they were testing. So certainly an active regimen. And this study told us, like, well, the triplet is likely to be better than a doublet. And so this became an FDA-approved regimen and standard of care for the treatment. However, if you look at comparing the toxicities across the three regimens, FOLFIRINOX, the original one, NALIRIFOX, Napoli 3, and gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel from Napoli 3, and you see that neutropenia is really much more with FOLFIRINOX. And then you look at things like fatigue, you expect to be more vomiting. The only thing that really stands out with NALIRIFOX would be the diarrhea, as you can see. And obviously hyperkalemia comes with it. So something to give an idea about the side effects of the treatment. And on the right side, there's a nice graphical comparison between the regimens. So the question is, how do we really address this? And certainly one of the things you can do, two things. One is I check the UGT1A1 in all of my patients. If I need to reduce the dose, I do, although there's question of whether with Naridifox you need to do that. But the other thing, the most important thing, is that we do what we do as doctors. We adjust doses according to the patient's thing. We keep a close eye on the patient, especially the first cycle or two when they're getting, where if they have a reason in their body to not like the drug, it will be evident. And the other thing is that does it really work the same or tolerated the same to be working the same in younger than 70 or older? And the short answer is here. It's just as tolerable and efficacious. So age is not going to make a big difference in your choice, provided you do the right choice based on other factors that I started off earlier. So going back to the issue of the dose, what happens if I reduce the dose? Is it going to compromise the patient? Sometimes we start with a lower dose. You use your, you know, doctor's gut feeling and judgment. You say, I'm going to start with a lower dose. In fact, it was very interesting because what it showed, something which I always believed in for a long time, it's better to reduce the dose and treat patients longer than give them a blast and then patient gives up, you give up, and then you go to the next line of treatment. And you can see that patients who had dose reductions on the right side for liposomal irinotecan 50, 40, 32.5, 25, and the oxaliplatin 60 down to 30, if you look at the median overall survival, it really didn't change much. In fact, it might have improved a bit by reducing the dose because of what? Because when you do reduce the dose, you get a longer duration of drug exposure and higher cumulative. So this is a nice principle which applies to a lot of the treatments we do. It's not unique for this situation, but some things sometimes we forget to focus on. And then there were some real-world data on efficacy, toxicity, and the impact of KRAS mutational status. It's very interesting because we're seeing more and more real-world data coming along with the improvement in all the technologies and artificial intelligence and the databasing and all that. And those pieces of data are really very important. Sometimes they really match the importance of a randomized phase 3 trial. Anyway, it shows you here, one of the things I want to highlight is that in real-world data, the response rate is similar to what was reported in the study of around a third of the patients. And something which Dr. O'Reilly has always noticed in the past is that patients' mutational status can also influence the benefit of treatment, KRAS mutational status, that is.
So before you go on, I'm going to ask a question I've been asking investigators for a long time. I'm going to ask Vic this question as well, but I'll start out with you, Eileen. A real simple question. How do you approach first-line therapy in metastatic pancreatic cancer?
I think we have choices, so modified FOLFIRINOX, NALIRIFOX, or gemcitabine, paclitaxel. So I use all three, and as Philip mentioned, it's partly patient preference, whether people prefer to, you know, to use infusional therapy or concerns about alopecia and how to mitigate that, along with maybe their overall performance status and major organ function. These factors influence treatment, but all of them are used. I'm a big fan of modified dosing, and like Philip mentioned, you know, an ability to deliver the treatment and sustain it over time rather than incurring toxicity and having it on the shelf and not being able to treat, that benefits nobody. So I do think that, you know, within the dosings that we use with standard cytotoxic therapy, you know, we need a minimum, but we don't need to push it to toxicity.
So, Philip, what's your practice look like first-line, FOLFIRINOX versus NALIRIFOX? Which one do you tend to use more?
I tend to use more FOLFIRINOX because I've been moving towards NALIRIFOX over the last 1 year or so. With the use of NALIRIFOX, certainly I'm discovering a lesser degree of some of the toxicities. One of them is the neuropathy, as I mentioned, because in NALIRIFOX, you're reducing the dose of the liposomal irinotecan. You're reducing the dose of the oxaliplatin. Someone might think, well, I might get less benefit, but what it shows is that doesn't happen, because even with 60 milligram compared to 85, you're getting the same thing. And this is the reason why in our institution we moved towards the NALIRIFOX, because of that reason. We also want to bring it to the neoadjuvant setting. We use a lot of perioperative treatment. That's another reason. And those patients, we want to keep them as, you know, as clean as possible in terms of side effects, because they go to surgery. So all these things have really, it shows that it's a better regimen when it comes to tolerance. The diarrhea stands out, but then again, you have to know how to manage it to be proactive and also reduce the dose if you have to. A lot of times we do, actually. It's more than reducing from 50 to 40, can kind of go down to the early 30s also. So all these things, if you really play it right, it's a regimen that's well tolerated, better tolerated when it comes to some of the side effects I mentioned, the neuropathy and the neutropenia.
So Vic, Philip was talking about the real world. You're in the real world, and also I know you all do some great data. I don't know if you looked at the FCS practice. How are you approaching first-line therapy? Any questions you want to put out there?
Yes, so very similar to the thought leaders. Nalirifox is definitely better tolerated. Have good luck with it. Less oxaliplatin dosing. I have two main questions. One is, I have some really senior patients, like in the 90s, okay? And then generally, reasonable performance score. I have occasionally done gem, nab-paclitaxel every other week. Do you folks have any data about that?
Eileen?
Yeah, that has been around for a while. And Tony Saab, our colleague from Mayo Clinic, he had an article years ago. And in fact, the GIANT trial, which is a study that was done in patients who are older, and in that study, it showed that doing it every other week is doable. And yes, I do that. And my threshold to reduce it to or change it to every other week is relatively low in patients who are older or performance status, or they have a lot of side effects like fatigue, the neuropathy, the neutropenia, then you can do it every other week.
So Eileen, why don't you take Vic's next question?
Yeah, my second question is, every so often we have these super responders. You've given them treatment at 3 years out. So at what point do you stop oxaliplatin, and when do you start to worry about the liver toxicity? Because I have a patient who's amazing response, 3.5 years, and then next thing we know is she's developed a fatty liver and signs of cirrhosis.
Yeah, great question, and you're right. We do see this small subset. So usually for oxaliplatin, typically we'll give 4 to 6 months, and usually dose reduce and stop at that point, and often continue maintenance FOLFIRI. Increasingly thinking about integrating local therapies, and we use a lot of radiation now selectively, both to the primary and to limited sites of metastatic disease to address that. And I do think for a subset of these individuals, we can take a treatment break depending on their disease burden, obviously their preferences, and what our overall goals in terms of treatment are.
Thank you.
So Vic, you actually asked me a question. I was curious what your thought, what was behind it, role of pancreatic enzyme replacement.
Yeah, so this is always a very tricky issue in practice because GI consultation is not readily available. GIs are great with lots of things, but in terms of helping with pancreatic insufficiency, I find it a little bit lacking. So how do the thought leaders approach pancreatic enzyme replacement when you're treating these patients?
Eileen?
Go for it. I think most patients will benefit from this, and it's probably, honestly, one of my favorite drugs as a pancreatic physician, just in terms of benefit. You know, definitely some don't, but I think it's worth trying. Our tools for assessing this are mostly clinical, right? Oil, greasy stools, odor, voluminous bowel movements, etc. You can check fecal elastase, but really it's a clinical decision, and I think most patients will benefit.
Do you use Creon or any other?
Yeah, any of the, there's 3 or 4 branded products. There's no generics, so pancrelipase, Creon, Zenpep, Pangestine.
So, Philip, before we get to the start of our show, and I'm thinking about Duroxo. How about that as a nickname? I don't know. We got to come up with something shorter than this. Anyhow, let's get back to NAPLI-1.
So, NAPLI-1 trial was beyond first line, second line, and you really have to look at this trial for a couple of reasons. One is you know about it probably. It's the study that established liposomal irinotecan and gave it an FDA approval in this second line setting. They use 70 milligram. I have to say that a lot of times I give the treatment, I probably start with a 50 milligram. And the other thing to really look at this trial is that you really have to get the statistics from this trial, because what you will hear from Dr. O'Reilly in terms of the KRAS inhibitor second line, you have to make a comparison there. She'll probably do it for you. So this study showed a benefit from giving the combination versus the 5-FU leucovorin. They had a single agent testing of the drug, but I'm not including it because that arm is not the one which we talk about. Side effects, as you expect, diarrhea, a bit of more vomiting, fatigue, etc., neutropenia, as you would expect with combination therapy. So this is a standard of care now. We use it in the second-line setting in pancreatic cancer. And also, it can be a regimen for patients who we talked about, the older patients, like in the GIANT study, which I'm referring to, a phase 3 trial. They put a comparison between this and the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel every 2 weeks. So just to finish off, this is my last slide, and a couple of comments about this slide. You can see that in the front line, we talk about gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, FOLFIRINOX, NALIRIFOX in some kind of a comparison. But I also included gemcitabine cisplatin, as I mentioned to you earlier, because we use it in patients with germline mutation BRCA or PALB2, and there's an excellent article that was authored by Dr. O'Reilly in JCO a number of years ago showing excellent response. It's a platinum compound, and you need it. If you look at the frontline setting, we haven't really crossed the barrier or the ceiling of 1 year median survival, and we crossed it only when we had patients who had BRCA mutations with the treatment that we gave. However, what the field is moving into is that we're going to be crossing that barrier multiple times, and the major one will be at this time with the RAS inhibitors. So once you get results of the RAS inhibitor in frontline, I bet my whole money up on that it will really easily cross that one-year barrier. So in the second line, we have talked about NALIRI and 5-FU, but you can see that daraxonrasib is trying to find its way there, and that's going to be the game changer probably when the FDA approves it in the next coming month, few months. And the rest of it is that you can try all the other ones, including single agent. I personally don't use single agent chemotherapy very rarely, because to me it's next to saying it's a placebo, and I'd rather be honest with the patient and talk to them about what's happening and direct them more into supportive care, palliative care, rather than give them a single agent treatment. Certainly, one thing which doesn't show in the slide is what do you do as a maintenance? You give someone 6 months of any of these combinations in the front line, how do you go about maintenance? And that's an important point, especially now it's going to be an important point when we have the availability of the anti-KRAS drugs. That's going to be something to be discussed. So with that, I just want to go back and just read you the second line at the top. A clinical trial must always be considered before starting treatment, front line, second line, third line, whatever. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to move on now, and I'll talk about these exciting new developments. And Eileen, you actually have my favorite slide of the entire weekend, which is the number of RAS drugs in development. And a real picture of what's going on today in pancreatic cancer. But anyhow, tell us about what we're about to deal with.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm the lucky person who gets to present some of the emerging data here in pancreas cancer. And as you said, it's a time of palpable excitement in the field. But just setting the scene and a reminder for us all that RAS mutations are common across multiple malignancies, but pancreas cancer is the disease of RAS, right? Almost everybody has an alteration in RAS or the MAP kinase pathway, 95% of people plus. And while the focus right now is on pancreas, non-small cell lung cancer, and colon cancer, clearly these drugs are going to have impact across multiple diseases. And when we look at what RAS means prognostically, in the subset of people who have no RAS mutation, they do better. For those who have a RAS mutation, D is less favorable in terms of outcome, and V, these are G12, that's 35-40% and about 30% of people with pancreas cancer. And the group of people who do best with the RAS mutation in relative terms are those who have a G12R mutation, about 15%. And this is going to become important as we get into allele-specific inhibitors or targeting specific RAS mutations.
This is it.
Yes, this is the slide that you were, and it's out of date already, probably from, you know, when I put it together a number of weeks back. But yeah, this is excitement. And just to notice here, this is pancreas cancer. This is not lung cancer. This is pancreas cancer in terms of where the field is moving. Just to, again, to illustrate the potential here based on a target and now drugs that have clear efficacy. So brief recap on the types of targeting drugs that are present. We have the mutant-specific or allele-specific inhibitors, the prototype being G12C, but coming in the clinic are G12V. There are multiple D inhibitors in the clinic and probably at some later point Q61, which is about 5% of people with pancreas cancer. And they target in the covalent, so they're irreversibly bound, or the non-covalent. They target this on-off state RAS cycling between an off state and an on state. And then this new class of drugs, these tri-complex multi-RAS on inhibitors, which are game-changing in pancreas cancer. And we've recently seen some data published on the degraders mentioned in the prior talk as well, just a completely different mechanism and also each of these drugs and approaches have different mechanisms of resistance. So moving to some of the clinical data here, this is the summary in the G12C story in pancreas cancer. So a single amino acid substitution from guanine to cysteine. And we have multiple drugs that have been looked at in small cohorts in pancreas cancer. It's about 1 to 2% of people with this disease. And as you look at the first generation RAS inhibitors to the more recent G12C inhibitors, you'll see the response rates get better, and some of these relate to the mechanism of targeting. But overall, we see in previously treated pancreas cancer response rates of 20, 30, 40%, and median progression-free survivals of 4 to 7 months. None of these are randomized data. Right now, sotorasib and adagrasib are in the NCCN guidelines, so we do use them for the small subset of individuals that have G12C mutations. So moving to the current data and where the field is poised for change, this is daraxonrasib, or RMC-6236, a tri-complex pan-RAS inhibitor targeting the on state of RAS. So it binds something called cyclophilin in the cells and then binds to the RAS molecule and then switches off this downstream proliferative growth metastasis signaling. So these are the data here in previously treated pancreas cancer, looking at the second-line cohort. This is an oral drug given once daily at 300 milligrams. That's the dose that's moved forward in pancreas cancer, which I'll note is different to lung. But you'll see that the waterfall plot, almost every single patient has a downward signal. And again, this right there is kind of stunning in previously treated pancreas cancer when we see response rates with chemotherapy of about 10, maybe 15% if we're generous. So overall response rates were 29 to 35%, depending on whether you looked at the G12 RAS mutant population or the all mutant population. And now if you look at the progression-free survival and the overall survival, progression-free survival of 8 months plus and overall survival of 13 months. Now, acknowledging this is a select group of patients in previously treated pancreas cancer setting, but just to reference what Dr. Philip mentioned a few minutes ago, median survivals are still haven't really broken a year in frontline settings. So right there, again, you see the what's going to be, I think, a very differentiated oncologic signal. So looking at the side effects, the few things as we see these drugs hopefully move into practice soon is that rash, which is an on-target effect. We have lots of wild-type RAS in our skin, and rash is an issue, and that's gotten some publicity recently, some mucositis and some GI toxicity. The rash is mostly managed, and the GI and mucositis, by using prophylactic measures first, so using oral antibiotics, using topical steroids, minimizing sun exposure, moisturization. But if those things haven't worked, may require a pause on the drug, hold and then reintroduce, often at the same dose. But if the same toxicity grade emerges that's significant, then resulting in a dose reduction. See, these are data from the second line setting. So this is the practice-changing study. This is the RASolute 302 trial schema, and this is comparing daraxonrasib as a single agent to investigator's choice current standard chemotherapy options, again, that Dr. Philip outlined in good performance status setting, ECOG 0 to 1, including all comers, and that's an important point. Primary endpoint here was progression-free survival and overall survival in the G12 population, and then in the overall population, and also looking at response and duration. So that's the schema. This trial accrued incredibly rapidly, as you might anticipate. A global study opened in late 2024 and completed accrual in 2025, and these data were announced almost 2 weeks ago now. This is the top line readout that this trial at its first analysis met all its primary and secondary endpoints. And if you look at the top line data for overall survival, again in second line setting, 13.2 months, right, compared to 6.7 months with a hazard ratio of 0.4, and bet all the study pre-planned estimates. So really kind of a striking result, and we look forward to seeing all of these data, you know, publicly disclosed at the ASCO plenary session in a month.
So, yeah, I was just wondering, when was the last time pancreas was in the ASCO plenary session? But, yeah, this looks exciting. Philip, any thoughts about the toxicity? You know, it looked like grade 3. There wasn't that much grade 3 with this, but a little bit more granularity about quality of life with this drug.
So you're right. I mean, sometimes we minimize the role of grade 2 with some of the side effects like rash. However, there's no question that this is going to be, if you look at the benefit-risk kind of equation we always apply in our patients, the key thing here will be to get the experience in terms of managing the rash. If you remember when you started using capecitabine many years ago, the hand, foot rash and all that, now no one has a problem using it because you just have to get to understand the best way to manage it. And this will be applying education to us as physicians, to our advanced practitioners, and also to the nurses in the clinic, and to really be able to do the management. Dermatology referral is one thing, but I personally think that these things, it's better that my team know how to do it before, because it takes time for that thing to happen. It will be interesting that there will be maybe less patients going to the infusion area because of, obviously, it's a pill form treatment. So everything will be for us, the outpatient, to understand how to manage it. I'm not concerned about it, given my experience in the past, including capecitabine.
So, Vic, you know, I used to joke that oncology today, now as your oncologist wakes up in the morning, checks their phone, sees what's just been approved, and then decides what to do about it. You all are always in the situation of new drugs coming in. What are some of the questions you have right now as you start thinking about moving forward?
So a couple of questions. One is in patients with borderline resectable pancreatic cancer, how do you choose between just neoadjuvant chemo versus what is the role of chemo radiation? Do you just start with neoadjuvant chemo if they have an inadequate response or a different approach?
Eileen?
Yeah, so for borderline resectable disease, our initial strategy is systemic therapy, and all of the regimens that we discussed earlier are used. In terms of adjudicating how long to go with neoadjuvant therapy and whether to integrate radiation or whether to integrate a systemic treatment switch, I think it depends on the response. So clinically, is somebody's pain getting better if they have pain? What's happening to their biomarkers? Is their CA99 going down? It is hard on the first scan because chemotherapy, it can be hard to see response, right? There's a lot of desmoplasia, a lot of stromal components. So I do think imaging can underestimate response. And as always in the localized setting, this is a discussion with our multidisciplinary team, our surgeons, our radiation oncologists, of course, the patient and their family. Again, what are we trying to accomplish? What's realistic? And if a goal is surgery and that's a realistic goal, then yes, we'll be thinking about all of these strategies. If it's clear we're not going to surgery, then maybe I'm tempered a little bit in terms of not rushing to switch treatment too soon, given that we have finite choices. But more coming.
Any questions about these new KRAS inhibitors that are coming up? We have this big presentation coming up now at the ASCO meeting with Duroc. So any questions you have about utilizing it, you may be utilizing it this summer.
So I think we're very comfortable managing the rashes. EGFR inhibitors have taught us a lot. So for 95% of my patients, I don't need dermatological referrals, although we have them on standby, and they're very helpful, and they are in tune as well with all the agents we're using. So my bigger question will be, is there anything unique about these? You kind of mentioned a few things that we should be watching out for as we start to roll them in practice.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of both of your observations that oncologists are very familiar with rashes, and managing them, though, is going to be a learning curve, I think, for us all as we utilize these drugs more freely. I do think that a consideration is dose intensity, but at the same time, you know, people's tolerance for rash varies a lot, and that'll depend, again, on the individual person. I sense that we may end up, you know, with either some interruptions or maybe ultimately at slightly lower doses for some patients to sustain it. But I think at the beginning, we'll start at the recommended dose and see, you know, how this evolves in practice.
Any role of prophylactic antibiotics like we do with doxycycline?
Yeah. I mean, they are utilized, and they weren't at the very beginning, but are now incorporated along with topical steroids. And there's a whole variety of approaches being investigated to address the rash, including, you know, topical antibiotics, everything from topical ivermectin to ruxolitinib to immune modulating agents. So we'll have to see how all of this sort of pans out and what will ultimately be the best strategies to manage. But I think it's going to be a learning curve.
Some of my patients will be very happy to hear they can finally use ivermectin for my approval.
I know, I was thinking the same thing when you said ivermectin. Really? All right, well, let's just finish out with a couple more. And you can check Eileen's deck. There's a ton of other new agents that are maybe a little farther along than coming out. I was thinking GemNab's kind of like the Palbo of pancreatic, better tolerated, so that's what people combine it with, like in breast cancer, they're combining stuff with Palbo. Anyhow, what about Duroxo plus GemNab?
Yeah, so this is getting RAS-targeting therapy into the front line. These are fresh data presented at AACR earlier in the week, showing activity for single-agent Diraxon/RASIB. And just to look at this, right, response rate of close to 50% as a single agent in the frontline setting with, I think, very promising disease control and six-month OS rates. These are not, you know, overall very mature data sets. Combined with chemotherapy, this is using 200 milligrams of Diraxon/RASIB, and then every other week, gemcitabine in a paclitaxel setting, you probably bump up those response rates about 10% and maybe a little bit more disease control. And the rationale for that is delaying resistance and getting ahead of what we know might be inevitable for this class of drugs. And these two strategies are the backbone of this particular trial. This is the RASolute 303 trial that activated in February of this year, comparing single-agent Diraxon/RASIB plus chemotherapy to standard of care, gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. And this, you know, will, I think, also accrue very briskly before Diraxon/RASIB is, you know, likely available in a second-line setting and can impact potentially getting RAS inhibitors into the frontline disease setting for pancreas cancer. So different class of drugs, the mutant-specific or allele-specific inhibitors, going back to G12D being the most common RAS mutation that we see in pancreas cancer. These are also highly active drugs with perhaps a slightly more favorable toxicity profile because we're not targeting the wild-type RAS, we're not targeting the skin, so we see little GI toxicity, low-grade rates of GI toxicity, and almost no cutaneous toxicity. And again, very nice waterfall plot. So probably more combinable with some chemotherapy regimens in pancreas cancer. So again, a lot happening in the RAS space, and it's kind of a race now to the front line, I think.
I'm really curious what our pancreatic module is going to look like next year. Sounds like it could be a time for a really great change. I hope this is hope, not hype. We'll see how much. I don't know if there's a really osimertinib-looking numbers in that waterfall plot, but maybe we're getting there. Final question back to you, Eileen. You mentioned, I think, lung cancer, but what about these agents outside of pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, I think they're going to have a role in the hematologic world, right, in NRAS and HRAS mutations occurring in various leukemias, in ovary cancer, in biliary cancers, in small bowel malignancies, just to name a few, and that's beyond lung, pancreas, and colorectal.
So a lot to talk about there. Thank you so much. We're going to come back talk about ovarian cancer. Thank you so much.